was. Shay, you're alive. Oh, gods, where are they taking you? Thank you, he said to the woman. Turning back to Vaughan, he said, I'm leaving the city, and I need a favour. I'll help if I can, the kindly man said. Keep her safe. He nudged Princess Rhea toward him. Finally, something registered in her expression. Don't leave me, she said. Take me with you. It was the second time she'd asked him not to leave. The first time he'd ignored her, and it had cost him his hand and put his sister at risk. He looked at the shock and sorrow on her face, at her soaked hair dangling from her scalp, at her bloodied, drenched nightclothes clinging to the curves of her body. In another life he could have loved her, could have treated her better. If he was a different person, or if she was born a commoner, or if the stars were aligned perfectly in the night sky, twinkling as the moons kissed at midnight. But he wasn't. He was an orphan and a thief, and the brother of a marked girl who needed his help more than Rhea did. And she was a princess of the Western Kingdom. And the moons and stars? The moons were at opposite ends of the darkness, as far from each other as he'd ever seen them, one green and one red. The stars were scattered throughout the night sky, sparkling like fate's gemstones, ruby, emerald, and topaz. Occasionally the rubies streaked across his vision, while the emerald seemed to explode again and again and again. I'm sorry, he said. I can't. He wrenched her hands from his arm and strode off into the pouring rain, heading for the southern gates. Surprising even himself, he stopped and whirled around, looking back. He could see the hope in her eyes, that he wouldn't leave, that he would rush back to her and hold her in his arms. "My real name isn't Grease Jolly," he said. "It's Grey. Grey Aris." Once more he spun around and raced toward the gates. As he ran, he felt a piece of himself break off and fall away as he heard her sobs. But he didn't look back again. 19. The Northern Kingdom, Silent Mountain. Bane. Bane was covered in blood, slumped against the wall of the cave, staring at his hands. His fingers were spinning a knife, and he watched the firelight reflect off the lifeblood of the dozens of men he'd killed in a single night, including the Western King himself. "Demon," many of them had cried. Other words as well. Monster, beast, creature, evil. He was all of those things. Not that it mattered. You can't change what you are. A wolf was a wolf, and would always hunger for fresh prey. Although Bear Blackboots claimed it was his choice whether he was evil or not, Bane knew it wasn't true. Bear hadn't even bothered to wait for him to return from his killing spree, as if he was afraid to see what Bane had become. Monster. Creature. Beast. Demon. Evil. Some had prayed to their god, Wrath. Not that it had changed anything. He could still hear the beating of their hearts in his head, slowing, slowing, stopping. He pressed a hand to his own chest and felt nothing. Did he even have a heart? Or was it an empty chasm roaring with death's fire? And if he did, why could he not feel its beat? Had it long ago turned black and hard, a lump of compacted obsidian in his chest? The surface of his head was on fire, and he knew it was because another eighth of his death mark had been filled with blood. The blood of the Western King. He didn't know if the King was a bad man or not, only that he had to die. Bane's carnal instincts had urged him to kill dozens of the knights and guards too. The fear the massacre would cultivate was somehow important to the cleansing of the Four Kingdoms, the fulfilling of the Western Oracle's prophecy. He wondered if his skin would ever be clean again. With an angry snarl, he wrenched off his blood-drenched cloak and flung it into the fire. Next was his shirt, his trousers, his socks, his undergarments. His boots he kept. He would try to scrub them clean because they weren't as easily replaced. Naked, he watched the blood of the West crackle and burn. In the flames, he swore he could see every moment of his life flashing by, one by one. He saw good days, like painting pictures on the cave walls with Bear, and he saw bad ones, like when he'd slipped and fallen, breaking his leg in the process. Each memory was devoured by the fire. Gone. Incinerated. Once the fire had consumed the sins of the night and the memories of a life he once loved, he had nothing left, tumbling onto his side, spent. His body shook as if struck by lightning bolt after lightning bolt. He lay by the ring of stones and closed his eyes, waiting for his death mark's next instructions. A vision blazed through his mind. As he watched the events unfold, he twitched at the sheer violence of men. Of him. When the images faded away, his eyes flashed open. He knew where he would be called next. Raiders Pass. And there would be blood. Exhaustion took him once more. Part 3. Rhone, Anise, Greece, Rhea. The death mark and life mark are the greater of the fate marks, while the rest are lesser. But that does not diminish their importance, as all who bear marks shall have a role to play in what is to come. The Western Oracle. 20. The Eastern Kingdom, northwest of Feria, Ironwood. Rhone. Gwendolyn had apologized for dumping him out of her hammock. Rhone was surprised, considering she'd never apologized before, not even after she'd stabbed him in the gut. Women are strange and unpredictable, Rhone mused as his horse trotted along beside hers. At least this time around he wasn't tied up, even if he felt the king's men watching him like all hawks. They'd been travelling through the immensity of Ironwood for hours, heading northwest. Toward home, Rhone mused, shaking the thought away as quickly as it had sprouted up. I have no home. And yet it was the west where he knew he had to go, a place where his Tatuya could get him killed. He remembered what Gwen had said a day earlier about what Westerners had once called the marks. Fate marks. Did that mean there was more to his existence than randomness and chance? It's just a word, he reasoned. And anyway, the Westerners would rather slaughter me than speak to me. According to the king, who was riding at the head of the column, they were making their way toward Raiders Pass, the neck of the north. We go for the jugular, the large man had said as he led them through the castle gates. Rhone had subconsciously touched the fragile skin of his neck, feeling for a pulse. Rhone and Gwen were well back from the front, but still in the first third of the legion, which was comprised of hundreds of well-armored men and women bearing all manner of weaponry. The three princes rode up and down the column, trading quips with their soldiers, each of whom they seemed to know personally and by name, a fact that didn't fail to impress Rhone. These trees have been here for thousands of years, Gwen said, gesturing to some of the tallest trees in the forest. They rose majestically toward the sky, sheathed in intricate ironwork. They are our gods, along with the ore that protects them. Rhone raised an eyebrow. So, basically, you worship nature. He was unable to keep the mocking from his tone. Gwen fired daggers from her eyes, and he half expected her to draw her bow and aim it at his heart. Are the Southrons all that different? She said. They worship gods and goddesses of fire, of stars, of storm, of bird and beast. Are those your gods? I have no gods, Rhone said. What about Roth? Again, Gwen's dagger-sharp question seemed calculated, precise, probing. Roth is far too angry a god for me, Rhone said. The world is all that we have. After this, there is nothing. Then you are empty. Emptiness is better than angriness, Rhone shot back. Gwen cocked her head to the side, her silver hair shifting like moonbeams through a lace curtain. Explain. Rhone tried to find the right words to explain his feelings. His guardian's lectures came back to him. Why do the Westerners hate the Easterners? He asked. or the Easterners the Westerners. The Westerners find your lot godless because you don't believe in their God, in Roth, or the seventh heaven they live their entire life to try to reach. And the Easterners believe the Westerners are savages for brutally punishing sinners. And do you love the Southrons any more? To you they are heathens, barbarians. He clamped his mouth shut, fearing he'd said too much. Gwen said, "Go on. And the North? How do you explain them?" "The Northerners care only about avoiding the worst places in the afterlife. So their goal is to seek power and territory, but not cross some razor-thin line that will sentence them to a life of eternal damnation in a hell even colder than the one they already live in." "What are you saying? That we should all change our beliefs to accommodate each other's? Cast the ancient traditions of our forefathers aside for a fool's chance of peace?" Roan shook his head. The truth was, he didn't know. All he knew was that the current status quo hadn't worked for hundreds of years. The Four Kingdoms locked in a war that killed thousands each year, leaving the land filled with orphans and widows and sadness. Even as he was trying to communicate the same frustrations he'd argued with his guardians about as a child, he knew he was being hypocritical, because he didn't believe in anything but life. And yet he'd watched men and women die. Men and women he could have helped. "I don't know," he admitted. Gwen laughed. "At least my beliefs are clear," she said, "and useful. I speak to the Ore, and the Ore obeys. Orion's will be done." He couldn't argue with that. He'd watched her don her armor this morning before they'd departed for Rhea. The Ore had moved with the grace of a dancer, swirling up her legs, around her slim waist, upwards to her ribcage and chest, and finally curled around her neck and over her cheeks. As unpredictable as Gwendolyn was, Prince Gareth was impressively predictable. The prince wedged his horse in between them, already smirking. "Ho, Roan the Skinmarked! How is your ass on this fine morning?" Now that he wasn't required to hide his ability, every few leagues Roan allowed a portion of his power to seep into his hind parts. "Excellent, Your Highness," he said. "As supple as cured leather. And yours?" Despite himself, Roan smiled. He hadn't spoken to the prince since he'd shown him around the castle, and, strangely, he missed the pointless banter. "Riding is but an extension of walking to the Easterners," the prince said, spurring his stallion ahead. He veered to the left, forcing Roan's horse to rear up sharply to avoid a collision. Roan tried to cling to the saddle horn, but the angle was too steep, and he tumbled awkwardly to the ground. The prince circled around while Roan groaned, rethinking whether he'd missed Gareth's presence. Laughter surrounded him from the king's soldiers. "First lesson of horsemanship, Southron," Gareth said. "Always maintain control of your steed." The prince chuckled and trotted ahead. "He's right, you know," Gwen said, dismounting and helping Roan to his feet. "He could have just told me the first lesson of horsemanship," Roan griped, reaching out to secure his horse's reins. They remounted and continued on. "Lessons are learned better from experience," Gwen said. Roan thought back to all that he'd experienced over the years. He wasn't sure he'd learned a damned thing from any of it, except that the world was full of tragedy and heartache. As he mused over his past, he saw something streak across the edge of his vision. He jerked his head to the side, searching the trees and undergrowth. "See something?" Gwen asked. There was a twinkle in her golden eyes. "Something moved. It was fast. I saw something similar when we entered Ironwood the first time." "Hmm," Gwen mused, although Roan suspected she was playing a wicked game with him. Leaves rustled, and there was a flash of something metallic, there and gone, before Roan could lock his eyes on it. "What the hell is that?" he asked. It moved like, well, like Gwendolyn. Faster than the wind. Faster than lightning. "I thought you didn't believe in hell." Gwen's eyes sparkled. "If it moved like her, then maybe it was like her." "Someone you know," he said. "A cousin, perhaps."
He thought he was being clever, but then the thing dove from the opposite side, the barest glint of steel on the outermost edge of his vision. Roan tried to duck, but compared to the thing, he was as slow as tree sap. He felt claws sink into his flesh, and then muscles smash into his chest. Once more he flew off his mount, the beast landing atop him, its paws pinning him to the metal ground, its eyes angry silver, its mouth full of tiny daggers. It was cat-like in appearance, with black stripes interrupting the grey sheen of its metal armour, but far larger and stronger than the ornery tomcats that roamed the streets of Calypso searching for scraps. Roan pushed energy into his life mark, which burned in his chest, healing the scratches and bruises from the attack and subsequent fall. It helped alleviate the pain, but his powers would be useless when the beast bit his head clean off his neck. As if reading his mind, it opened its jaws wide enough to do just that, growling from deep in its throat. "Ho, Sasha!" Gwen shouted. "Off!" The cat snarled at him once more, and then bounded away, pushing off from his chest. Roan quickly rolled to the side, fought to his feet, and moved backwards from the creature, which apparently had a name, Sasha? Which stalked back and forth in front of him, like it was working off pent-up energy. Horsemen and horsewomen parted like a river around a stone, mostly ignoring them, although Roan caught a few laughs and smiles. Maybe he was supposed to be the jester, as Gareth had suggested. Gwen slipped from her horse with all the grace of a waterfall. She approached the beast, which stood almost as tall as her, its head reaching her chest. She extended a hand, palm down, and the animal nuzzled its muscular head against it, purring. "He's not the enemy," she said to the wildcat. Roan noticed she didn't say friend. Still, he would take "not the enemy" under the circumstances. "What is it?" he asked. "An orcat. This one is Sasha. Ironwood is full of them. She didn't recognize your scent, which made her angry." The orcat rubbed against Gwendolyn's leg, and she laughed. Sasha approached Roan, and he took a step back, stiffening. The cat growled. "She senses your fear," Gwendolyn said. "I'm not scared," Roan lied. "Let her sniff you." Roan held out a hand, but recoiled when Sasha snapped at it. The cat prowled closer, and the way she curled her lips almost looked like she was smiling. First she sniffed Roan's borrowed boots, scrunching up her nose at the smell. Then his legs and arms, her disgust seeming to grow with each odor. Finally, she backed away, growling. "She doesn't like you," Gwen said. "Oh, good," Roan said. As quickly as she arrived, the orcat leapt back into the forest, disappearing beneath the undergrowth with a metallic flash of her tail. Roan took a deep breath as they mounted up. He ignored Gwendolyn's amused grin. "Are there any other ore creatures I should know about?" "Well, there are the ore hawks you saw the day you arrived. But as long as you don't look up at them, they should leave you alone." Roan had no clue whether it was a jest or not, but he refused to rise to the bait and look up. Gwen laughed. "Also, keep your possessions close to you at night, or the ore monkeys might steal them. Come on," she said, spurring her horse forward. "Good thing I have no possessions," Roan thought. Still, he glanced at the trees, peering between the branches. He didn't see anything. Gwen was already moving away rapidly. He encouraged his mare to give chase, but quickly lost sight of the superior rider behind the ranks of mounted soldiers. He rode along the edge of the column, watching the forest warily for any movement that might suggest the presence of another orcat. Several of the men and women hailed him as he passed.
"Aye, Southrunner," they said.
Again, these Easterners were hard to read. He couldn't tell whether he was being mocked. He offered a raised arm in greeting and rode on. Eventually he reached the front, where the royal bannermen held flags bearing the royal sigil, flapping in the wind. The king was directly in the centre, his triplet sons riding behind. On one side was Gwendolyn, and on the other Bjorn Stonesledge, the iron-marked, his steed a massive armoured stallion that was surely the only horse that could bear the giant's weight. The scene felt like a metaphor for the East-West War. In the West, Gwen, Bjorn, and Roan would all have been killed the moment their so-called sin marks were revealed. In the East, they were revered, permitted to ride with the king. Two very different reactions to the same situation. And in the North, the marked were forced to serve the crown. Southrons were different still. Those bearing Tatuia almost worshipped like gods. Even stranger was the character who rode next to Gwendolyn, the man they called Bark, his brown, mottled flesh appearing as rough as sandstone next to the Orion's smooth as silk complexion. Evidently his metalwork was so highly valued that he was given a position of prestige amongst the battalion. Gwendolyn looked back and met Roan's eyes. She gestured for him to join them at the front. Pleasantly surprised, he weaved his way through the ranks and pulled up next to Bark, who was riding a grizzled horse that seemed on its last legs. The king craned his neck to look over.
"Ho, Roan, born of dust! How are you enjoying the ride?"
"Well, your highness, first your son knocked me from my horse, then a playful orcat named Sasha attempted to eat my head." "Very much, your highness," he said. The king smiled broadly, as if reading the unspoken truth directly from his mind.
"I heard you met Sasha."
Roan glared at Gwen, who smiled sweetly. "I told the king everything," she said. "Thank you. That will save me the trouble of telling the tale myself." One of the princes piped up from behind. Roan wasn't sure if it was Guy or Grian. "Tell us, Roan, why are you not in the service of the Calypsians? Surely the Sands would value a man of your rare abilities." Roan squirmed in his saddle. He wasn't used to talking about his mark with anyone but his guardian. Even then, it had always made him uncomfortable. No one knew about it. Gwen arched her thin eyebrows in surprise. "How is that possible? We discovered it so easily." "Because I rarely used it," Roan admitted. Gwendolyn narrowed her eyes. "Why not? Is there no suffering in Calypso? Are there not people in need of what you have to offer?" Shame slithered through him. "I have nothing to offer. I..." He couldn't admit the truth, that if he used his power and his father's spies discovered him, he'd be a dead man. "I was careful," he said.
"Why?
Why hide your true self?" It was Gareth this time. "It's not like you were in the West, where they'd execute you. The Southrons worship power like yours."
"You wouldn't understand," Roan said. "Just drop it, please."
Gareth started to question him further, but the king cut him off.
"The past is no matter. So long as, when the time comes, you do what is necessary for my brave men and women."
Roan didn't respond, his heart thumping in his chest. He stared straight ahead, even as he felt Gwen's scowl smashing into him from the side. When they finally cleared the edge of Ironwood, Roan found he could breathe easier once more. He wasn't used to being so enclosed. Calypso was an open city, the sky always visible, turquoise and hot in the day, and cooled and filled with both moons and a blanket of stars in the night. It also didn't hurt that he no longer had to worry about orcats pouncing from the shadows and eating his face, or orhawks diving from above and tearing off his scalp, or even ormonkeys stealing the shirt off his back or the boots from his feet. Ahead of the column of men and women soldiers was a land greener than Roan had ever seen, with rolling grasslands broken only by the occasional copse of overgrown trees. Their legion seemed to flow across the land like a silver river, making its way to some unknown destination, or to the sea, perhaps. Roan angled his mare's path toward Gwendolyn. They hadn't spoken in hours, and he was beginning to wonder whether she would ever speak to him again after having admitted he rarely used his Tatuia to help anyone in need. "Ho, forest dweller," he called, hailing her the way an Easterner would. "Ho, coward," she called back, and he couldn't help the sting he felt in his chest at her words. Gareth chuckled, riding beside her. Roan wished he could show her his memories of his escape from Dragon's Breath. Maybe then she wouldn't be so quick to judge his character. Then again, he had left thousands of the afflicted to rot or die a fiery death. So maybe he was a coward. Gareth said, "Your cheeks appear sunburned, Sir Dust," which only made Roan's skin grow even hotter. Gwen looked away. Maybe she was embarrassed for him. He gritted his teeth and let the cool air tame his cheeks. "Tell me," Roan said, "are all Easterners such jesters?" It was Gwen's turn to smirk. "Only the arrogant ones." Roan laughed, although her opinion didn't seem to affect Prince Gareth. "There's a fine line between arrogance and confidence," he said. "I prefer to keep one leg on either side, just like riding a horse." "You must be sore in the area between your legs, then," Roan quipped. "Not at all," the prince said, recovering easily. "Like all things in the East, I'm made of iron where it counts the most." Despite everything, Roan couldn't help but to appreciate the prince's quick wit. Prince Guy pulled up alongside his brother. "We shall see the truth in battle, brother," he said. "May the glory go to the fiercest warrior." He raised his sword in the air. "Then I shall receive the glory," Prince Gryan growled from behind. "Though war is not for glory." Although the darkness that seemed to be constantly in Gryan's eyes scared Roan a little, he couldn't help but to agree. "War only brings death," he said. King Ironclad split his sons in half, his enormous steed like an armoured battering ram. "Then we shall bring death to the north," he said, "and you shall bring life to the east with that skin mark of yours." Days turned to nights turned to days, and Roan soon tired of the constant greenery. To his surprise, he longed to feel a bit of sand beneath his feet, rather than the leather stirrups strapped to his horse. They camped for short stretches, riding long after dark and arising well before the sun peaked over the eastern horizon. Gwendolyn had less and little to say to him, which left him with only Gareth to talk to. Not that he minded, but at least most of the time. "She's likely to shoot an arrow through your eye if you don't stop staring at her," the prince said one day as they were riding. In truth, Roan hadn't been purposely staring at the Orion. The 4 hours of sleep had left him exhausted and listless in his saddle, and he had little control where his gaze landed. "Let her shoot," Roan said. "She's done worse." The prince tusked. "Your defeatist nature is a drag on my sunny mood. So find another riding companion." "I would, but my father has instructed me to keep both eyes on you." "Why? Is he afraid I might make a run for it?" The fact that the king and his sons believed they were forcing Roan to ride west made him laugh on the inside. In reality, they were going in the exact direction he wanted to go, more or less. "No, he's afraid you might die from a broken heart," the prince said, laughing. Something boiled over inside Roan. "I have done nothing to her, have no romantic interest in her, and her opinion of me is even less important than yours," he snapped. The prince held up both hands. "Whoa! I did not seek to offend thine soft and furry ego. I fear my words struck closer to the target than I intended. Like many others, you have fallen for an angel as unreachable as the moon's, and as fierce as the sun's heat." "Gods, he's impossible," Roan thought. "I have fallen for no one. I suspect it is you that has fallen for her, am I right?" The prince smiled broadly. "I am human. I want what I cannot have, and I have no interest in that which is mine." Something about the way he said it, about the way he looked at Roan, made him wonder whether they were talking about Gwen any more. "Like the Eastern Throne?" The prince seemed to find this humorous. "Maybe you have a bigger rock for a brain than I initially believed. The throne is just a throne, while Gwendolyn's storm is molten ore." "But she will not have you." "No more than she'll have you, Southrunner." Roan remembered what Gareth had told him about the long lives Orion's lived. "But surely she's had mates.
She's been many years in this world, has she not?
Yes, at least 95, if my calculations are correct. Supposedly she was once bonded.
I shouldn't have brought you here, Gwen had said a day earlier after he'd persisted in asking about the poetry on the gate to her dwelling. Was he a poet, by any chance?
Gareth made a face.
You believe a strong woman like Gwendolyn would take up with an artist? Surely not. From what I've heard, he was a legionnaire.
Couldn't he be both a poet and a soldier?
Why do you persist in this line of questioning? Are you a poet hoping to romance her with fine words and tender prose?
Ha!
The prince chortled at his own wit. In truth, I would rather kiss you than her, Rhone said lightly. The prince laughed, but Rhone could tell it was forced, his cheeks blushing with embarrassment.
You are a fool, you know that. I would rather kiss my horse.
And yet he looked away, unable to meet Rhone's eyes. Rhone watched him carefully, and then twisted the subject back to Gwen.
What happened to her bondmate?
He perished in the dragon massacre, like many other legionnaires.
Rhone breathed through his nose. She'd lost so much in the war with the South. It was a wonder she spoke to him at all, much less looked at him.
And he was a pure Aurean.
Gareth squinted and cocked his head, eventually shrugging.
As far as I know. Which means rough-shod humans like you and I have as much chance as a worm crawling out of the muck.
He laughed loudly, which only made Rhone more certain the prince was overcompensating for something. Hearing the laughter, Gwen turned to look at them. The prince offered a wave and a sly smile, which she ignored, turning away. Something the prince had said earlier had struck a chord on the strings of his soul.
"You truly do not desire the Eastern Throne?" he asked.
Something unrecognizable flashed across Gareth's face, but quickly vanished beneath a smile.
"It is not mine to take."
Rhone frowned.
"But you are the eldest-born son, are you not? Even amongst multiple births, you would have rights."
"Legally, that is true," Gareth said. "But we have our traditions."
"What traditions?"
"You would not understand."
"Try me."
Gareth looked away. Rhone had never seen him look so uncomfortable, especially when on horseback. Even Rhone's comment about kissing him hadn't unnerved the prince as much. The prince said nothing. Rhone pressed further.
"Why won't you take the throne that is rightfully yours?" he asked.
Gareth only shook his head and dug his heels into his steed's sides, spurring it away from Rhone. Rhone cocked his head to the side, but didn't give chase. A shadow fell upon him from behind, and he twisted about to find the king's enormous horse sprinting to catch up. The juggernaut slowed his steed, settling into an easy trot beside him.
"Ho, king," Rhone said.
"Ho, healer," the king said. "Well met. What say you?"
"I say I'm ready for a long sleep," Rhone said.
The king chuckled.
"The dead may sleep, while the living must soldier on."
Rhone didn't feel like arguing about kingdoms and war with a man who seemed as disinterested in peace as the Southron emperors and empresses. Instead, he asked, "Why is Prince Gareth loath to inherit your crown?"
"He is the shield," the king said evenly, "as my eldest brother was before him."
"How can a man be a shield?" Rhone said, trying to understand.
"By protecting those he loves."
"Meaning?"
"A life to save a life."
Wait. Rhone remembered something the prince had said back at Baronwood, something cryptic about dying long before he'd have a chance to be king. At the time, he thought it was just another one of Gareth's flippant remarks. "He wants to die to protect his brothers."
"Want might not be the best word to choose. But, yes, he will eventually die to save Prince Guy, who is next in line for the throne. It is his duty as the eldest brother, as the shield."
Rhone squinted, although the sun was not bright.
"You mentioned you had an older brother, that he was killed by Northerners."
"Corrin," the king said. "A year older than me. He was known as Thunder because of his booming voice.
Was. Something clicked and turned, like a key in a lock.
He died to save your life, Roan said.
The king said nothing, just stared ahead, a wistful look barely visible beneath the shadows cast by his thick, dark brows.
It all makes sense now, Roan thought. Gareth's devil-may-care attitude, his gallows sense of humour, his cavalier attitude toward life and a throne he never intended to claim. He was the shield, destined to die for one of his brothers, so Prince Guy could live on and become King Ironclad. A royal tradition.
But why? Roan asked. Why must he die? Why can't the princes protect each other? Why can't they be each other's shields and allow Gareth to take the throne?
The king sighed, a deep huff of hot air.
I loved my brother, he said. Although he was only a year my elder, he seemed years more mature. He would have made a great king.
Then why didn't he? Why isn't he the king now?
The king offered him a narrow glance, but then faced forward once more, gazing into the distance, where his sons were racing each other across the grassy plains, always competing.
It was 12 years ago, during one of a series of battles at the Razor, he started. My father had taken ill, and thus the command of the Eastern Legions had fallen to Corran and I. Our scouts had discovered a hidden cave along the shoreline, one that had potential as an avenue through the cliffs. Prince Corran concocted a scheme in which we would split our force in two, with half scaling the black cliffs and distracting the northern defenders, while the rest pushed through the mountain, attacking by stealth from behind.
The king paused, licking his lips. Roan could almost see the memories flashing in his eyes. The dark, jagged cliffs rising against a grey northern sky, heavy white waves crashing on the rocks.
Corran made the decision to lead the group over the mountains, while he sent me through the caves.
What happened?
Roan asked, bringing his horse to a stop while the king did the same. King Orrin Ironclad slowly turned to face him.
We made it through, and when we did, the northern army was in disarray. Corran had led his armoured battalion directly through the middle of them, cutting them in two. It was a move the North hadn't expected, because it was suicide. He'd left his flanks open on both sides, and allowed the enemy to surround him. They thought they'd won. We came upon them from behind, killing at will. We killed thousands that day, while they only managed to end the lives of hundreds of our men and women, most of them from Corran's force. When I found my brother, he was still alive, but barely. His horse was lying atop him, dead, while he bled from a dozen wounds. Corran couldn't speak, but the look in his eyes said enough. I was your shield. Do not waste my sacrifice. Be the king you were always meant to be. Be strong, mine brother. We took Darin later that day, but lost it in a week's time, pushed into a full retreat through the tunnels by northern reinforcements. The Ice Lord was present, as was the Dread King of the North. They sealed the tunnel soon after.
Roan felt his eyes stinging. Not from sadness, but from anger at the pointlessness of it all. Of war, of killing.
Then your brother's death was for naught, he said.
The king's eyes were sword blades.
Say it again, and I shall end you, he said. My brother's death was for me. Just as my wife's death was for my sons, for her people, whom she loved. Corran paid the ultimate sacrifice so I would be a good king, so I would always remember what I lost to sit on the All Throne, so I would be honourable and wise and protect my people. Gareth will one day make the same sacrifice, and only then will Guy be able to become the king he was always meant to be.
With that, the king pulled his horse away, returning to his place at the front. A few moments later, Roan did the same, unable to stop thinking about what it would be like growing up knowing your life was not your own. They rode on, the sun reaching its apex as Roan snoozed in his saddle. He was jerked out of his fog when one of the forward scouts galloped back toward the head of the column, shouting loudly. Roan spurred his horse after Garrus, who'd moved in the direction of his father. They reached the king at the same moment the scout did.
"Ho, rider! What news?"
the king said.
"It's Glee,"
the rider said. His horse stamped his feet and panted, while several horsemen prepared water and oats for the animal, exhausted from the long sprint.
"What of the town?"
the king said. The rider shook his head. His shoulders slumped.
"It's riddled with the pox," he said. "I barely escaped with mine own health."
The king growled out a curse, and Roan knew exactly why. The plan from the beginning had been to ride hard and fast, and thus they'd purposely kept supplies to a minimum. They'd intended to resupply at the two major towns along the way, first Glee and then Norris.
"We can divert to Portage," Prince Guy suggested. "If we ride hard, we will make it in 3 days."
Roan squinted, trying to remember the old maps his guardian had showed him from time to time. The eastern and western kingdoms were separated by the Spear and Hiero Lake. He could faintly picture Portage as a border town on the eastern edge of the Great Lake.
"Our forces will be starving in two," the king said.
"Plus, the western legions have been harassing Portage for days," Prince Gryon said. "We will be required to stay and fight. The people will see us as saviors and reinforcements."
"What about changing course toward the northeast?" Garrus said. "Crow's Nest?"
Roan knew much of Crow's Nest, the northernmost city in the Eastern Kingdom. It was located on the rocky elbow where the Mournful Mountains met the Black Cliffs near the northern castle of Darin. With the exception of the tale the king told about his brother's death, neither the north nor the east had had much success traversing the razor-sharp cliffs in order to penetrate their enemies' lands.
"We'd be better served retreating to Ironwood," the king muttered. "No. We ride on for Raiders Pass. We will reach Norris almost as fast as we would Portage. We'll begin half-rations when we next make camp."
"What about Glee?"
Gwendolyn said, entering the conversation. Roan tried to catch her eye, but she was arrow-focused on the king and his sons.
"Glee is not our concern," the king said.
Gwen narrowed her eyes, and Roan was suddenly glad she wasn't looking at him.
"You are the king, are you not?" she said. "And they are within the bounds of your kingdom, yes?"
Roan gawked at her nerve. In the south, speaking to a member of the Sands royal family in such a way would only guarantee that your tongue would be served at their next meal, marinated and fried. And yet here, in the east, the king only looked amused.
"I am the king, and this is my kingdom. We will send word of Glee's predicament to the Orion healers in Ironwood. That is all we can do."
Gwendolyn wasn't about to be placated by such a response.
"The healers will be too late. There will be no one left. The pox spreads like wildfire."
The king sighed, and despite the huge size differential between he and Gwendolyn, for once he almost appeared smaller.
"What would you have me do?"
Her eyes were golden steel as she finally turned to face Roan.
"You have the ultimate healer riding with you. Send Roan to prove his worth."
21. The Northern Kingdom, approaching Gearhead. Anise Gerrick. Terran refused to speak to Anise, or even look at her. Ever since she stopped him from killing the tree farmer, he was like a deaf, mute monolith, responding only in grunts and head nods as he dragged the three dead soldiers into the trees and buried them beneath the snow. She'd sent the farmer and his wife inside to get warm, and she wanted so badly to follow them, but she wouldn't until Terrin was finished. She was scared to leave him alone with the last soldier, who eased in and out of consciousness, like a lake trout slipping above and below dark waters. The soldier occasionally moved his arms, but his legs were like stone, and Anise was pretty sure he was paralyzed from the waist down. Four soldiers. One armored knight. No contest. Despite the exceptional fighting ability she'd seen Terrin display during the melee, she wasn't prepared for the level of violence he'd unleashed on these northern soldiers. It made her unlikely defeat of the Ice Bear on the Howling Tundra appear nothing more than child's play.
Frozen hell! He was like a man possessed. And that look in his eyes as he choked the farmer.
It scared her deep in her gut, where she felt a dark hole open up that was more than just gnawing hunger. Terin finished with the dead men, his armor smeared with blood, and then stood over the final soldier, who was, at present, sleeping in the snow, his chest rising and falling. Terin bent down and slipped a knife from the soldier's belt, ran a gloved finger along the blade, slowly, pressed it to the man's throat.
"Wait,"
Anise said. Terin didn't move, a statue once more.
"We should question him."
Terin paused for a moment, and then gave a slight nod, retracting the blade and standing. He took two big steps back and gestured for Anise to move forward. She moved next to the fallen soldier and knelt down, pinched his leg hard. He didn't react.
"Definitely paralyzed."
"Oi,"
she said. He didn't react. He was still breathing, hot vapors escaping his lips, which were beginning to look pale blue. She grabbed him by the top of his breastplate, lifting him up off the ground. He was heavy in all his armor, but Anise had always been strong. She'd once heard one of the lordlings refer to her as being strong as an ox. She'd been confident it wasn't a compliment, so she'd forced him to eat yellow snow. Anise shook the soldier, but still he slept. She glanced at Terin, who pretended not to watch. Holding him with one hand, she pulled the other hand back and then swung it in a vicious arc. The man's eyes shot open when she slapped him, a gasp bursting from his lips. He stared at her, his eyes twitching back and forth. He tried to land a punch, but Anise grabbed his arm and forced it down, pressing a knee to his chest, consolidating her strength into a single point. Without use of his legs, and without any leverage, the soldier slumped back, resigned.
"What are you doing out here in the middle of nowhere?"
Anise asked gruffly.
"You're her," the soldier said.
"I get that a lot," Anise said.
"You're Princess Anise,"
he frowned.
"What happened to your face?"
Anise pressed down harder.
"I wrestled an ice bear. The bear lost."
The man groaned, but shut up.
"Are you going to answer my questions?"
she asked. He nodded.
"Good. What is your mission?"
She released some of the pressure so he could speak.
"You're going to kill me," the soldier said.
"Not if you answer my questions."
The man looked at her, but said nothing. Anise reached a hand toward Terin, flexing her fingers. He understood her meaning, hesitating only a moment before handing her the confiscated knife. She gripped it tightly, and then shoved the blade toward the soldier's face, stopping a hair's breadth from his eye. The soldier's breathing accelerated.
"Fine, fine, frozen hell, woman,"
he gasped.
"I'll talk. We were sent to find you.
How many men are searching?"
Another pause. Anise slid the knife's edge along his skin, shaving off a ragged portion of his beard and cutting him in the process.
"Ah, what are you doing?"
"Sorry. Never done that before,"
Anise said.
"Want me to do the rest?"
"I was going to answer. I was just thinking. 300. Griswold hand-selected 300 soldiers to conduct the search. The grid stretches from Castle Hill to Gearhead to Wahlberg. We're hitting all the small towns and settlements within the Triangle."
"Not Darin?"
"King Griswold said it was too far east, that he couldn't spare any men away from the front lines."
Anise frowned, ignoring the false title given to her uncle.
"Front lines?"
"I can't feel my legs,"
the soldier said, his eyes suddenly going wide.
"Why can't I feel my legs?"
Anise grabbed his jaw and forced him to focus on her. What was left of the stubble of his beard was rough against her palm.
"Where are you supposed to go after you conduct your search?"
she asked.
"Half to Raiders Pass, the rest to Blackstone."
Terin had been right. Had they taken the main road along the edge of the Mournful Mountains toward Blackstone, they'd most likely have been captured already.
"What is happening at Raiders Pass?"
The passage through the mountains was too close to Gearhead for comfort. Arch was supposed to be at Gearhead. The king received a stream from our scouts in the east. King Ironclad and an entire legion is moving for the pass.
It could be a defensive maneuver, Anise said.
It's not. They are preparing for war.
Anise's heart fluttered. She knew she shouldn't be surprised. Her father, the king, was dead. Their enemies would expect the North to be in disarray, especially if they'd heard about Queen Loren's execution and Arch and Anise's escape. And what of Blackstone? Surely the West wouldn't risk an assault across the Bay of Bounty. Blackstone had never been taken, and most considered its seaward defences to be impenetrable. The soldier shook his head, and for the first time looked slightly amused.
No, he agreed. In a week's time, we'll launch our own offensive across Bounty.
What?
Anise couldn't hide the surprise in her tone. Her uncle had barely seized power, and already he was attacking one of their major rivals.
Why would Lord Griswold do that?
King Griswold learned of another royal death, this one in the west.
Anise cocked her head to the side.
Impossible.
One non-war royal death might be an accident, but two?
Impossible. King Loren is dead.
And most of his castle guards, if our spies aren't exaggerating in the streams they sent. Only the Furia managed to escape the city.
How? Escape from what?
Some say it was a ghost, others a demon. There were few survivors to tell the tale, and they were too traumatized to do much more than babble incoherently. We were lucky to learn anything at all. Regardless, Night's End is ripe for the picking, and King Griswold plans to take it.
Anise tried to make sense of the news, but all she could seem to think about was the eerie, disappearing boy that had appeared on the tower staircase. The boy who had set everything in motion, including her mother's execution. Was he the ghost? The demon? Had he really killed the Western guards and their king? A week ago the tale would have sounded like idle gossip, but now...
What else can you tell me?
Nothing,
the soldier said, his teeth beginning to chatter from the cold, or perhaps the shock of his injury. Anise believed him.
Now, please, can we go inside? I'm hungry.
That's not going to happen, Anise said.
You said if I answered your questions that you'd...
I lied, Anise said,
remembering the way he'd laughed at the farmer and his wife as he threatened their lives.
Step aside, princess,
Taryn said, finally breaking his silence. He grabbed Anise's arm, but she shrugged him off.
I'll do it, she said, looking back at him.
His eyes burned into her, but then he nodded. She stared at the knife's razor-sharp edge, glinting in the white sunlight reflecting off the snow. In the shiny silver blade, she saw her mother's eyes just before she dropped from the gallows. As much as she tried to make herself believe she was going to kill this man to avenge her mother, she knew it wasn't true. No, she was doing it because she was scared to see Taryn kill again, scared to see that darkness in his eyes.
No,
the soldier pleaded. I was only following orders. You can't do this. You can't...
Anise slid the blade between his ribs, and she was shocked at how easily his skin and muscle parted to allow the blood to flow out of him.
No more difficult than cutting cheese, she thought.
The man gasped, blood bubbling from his lips. His back arched, his arms twitched, and then he went still.
You're the queerest princess I've ever met,
Taryn murmured.
You've met many princesses,
Anise said, trying to hide the quiver in her voice as she looked away from the corpse. It was so cold that his blood was already freezing in red streams and crimson ponds.
Well, no, Taryn said, but I'm certain none would be like you.
Something in his voice made her heart speed up, although she wasn't sure why.
Take care of the body, and then meet me inside, she said. And try not to scare the poor farmers when you enter.
The soup was thin, but hot and flavorful. Anise tried not to slurp as she ate. She was unsuccessful. She pretended not to notice the farmer and his wife gawking at her.
"You've never seen a princess eat before," she finally said, after she'd picked up her bowl and tipped it back to suck down the final dregs.
The woman went beet red, and the man looked away, pretending to fiddle with some kind of tool.
"We've never seen a princess at all," the woman said.
"Oh." Anise hadn't thought of that.
"Is there enough for another bowl?"
The woman nodded and refilled the dish.
"Thank you,"
Anise said, accepting the food. She drank this bowl slower, savoring it. Who knew when her next warm meal would be? The cottage was small but warm and cozy. A fire blazed in the hearth, which the woman had used to cook the soup. There was a small straw bed in one corner of the room, but other than it and the table and four chairs used to serve supper, the space was empty of furniture. A threadbare rug covered a small portion of the floor, which was constructed of long timber boards, cut and shaved smooth. Iron pots and kettles hung from wooden pegs hammered between the stone blocks that formed the walls. Near the door was a small rack for thick sheepskin coats, hats, and gloves. Snow-caked boots were lined up against the wall, puddles forming as the snow melted. For the first time in her life, Anise realized how good she'd had it in the castle. Hearty meals, soft beds. She hadn't used a chamber pot in days. She almost laughed at the absurdity of her thoughts. She never expected to miss her chamber pot so much. "I've been selfish to wish it all away," she thought, sipping another spoonful of soup.
"We owe the thanks to you," the woman said. "If you hadn't come along, who knows what might have happened?"
The man grunted, and it didn't sound like agreement. Anise looked up at her sharply.
"It was because of me the soldiers came here in the first place. It's my fault you almost... You can't control the actions of others," the woman said.
And then,
"I'm Moira. My husband is Killorn."
Anise really looked at the woman for the first time, taking in her storm-grey hair, which hung like curtains on either side of her face, her wrinkled skin, her sky-blue eyes. There was something comforting about her, something motherly. Anise had the urge to fall into her arms and spill out every emotion she'd felt since the melee. Instead, she said,
"Anise Garrick." "We know," the woman said. "Can I clean the cuts on your face? They're deep and susceptible to infection."
Anise raised a hand and touched her cheeks, which were finally warm again. She could feel the jagged lines where the bear had clawed her.
"Yes, thank you," she said.
Moira busied herself with a kettle of water, which she heated over the hearth. A few moments later, she positioned it on the table next to Anise, and used a clean wash rag to dab the warm water on her face. Soon the basin was tinged pink with Anise's blood.
"Shall I bind it?" the woman asked.
Anise considered the offer, but then said,
"No, thank you. It might be better for the air to dry and heal the wounds."
"Then it's time for you to go," the man said. "And your friend."
"Killorn," Moira chided. "The princess is our guest."
"According to the soldiers, she's a wanted criminal, and we're guilty by aiding her."
"She saved our lives."
"It wasn't me who saved you," Anise said quickly.
"It was my friend, the knight. And your husband is right. I put you at great risk. We should go." "Not until your friend has eaten. We owe him a life debt."
Killorn grunted and moved to shove another log into the fire.
"He didn't mean it,"
Anise said to the man's back. He stiffened.
"He was just trying to protect me. He would never hurt someone innocent. I swear it."
The man's shoulders slumped, and he turned back. Nodded once.
"Eat, and then go," he said.
"We will."
Anise glanced back at the door. Where was Taryn, anyway? He should have been back by now.
"He's standing outside," Moira said. "Shall I let him in?"
Anise shook her head, but it wasn't an answer. Of course Taryn wouldn't come in, not after what he'd done, or almost done.
"You can try," she said.
Moira scampered over to the thick oak door and hauled it open. Terin's massive frame filled the entrance, and Anis chortled when he flinched back.
"I've never scared anyone before," Myra said.
"Beg your pardon, ma'am," Terin said. "You just startled me."
"Well, come in before you let in a draught."
"I'd rather not."
Anis